welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. Today, we continue our series on landmark legal cases with a recent one, the 2010 case of Citizens United versus Federal Elections Commission. Depending on your point of view, the decision in this case either struck a blow for free speech or sounded a death knell for free and fair elections. While there has been much controversy and commentary associated with this case, many Americans are unclear about the specifics and consequences of this important decision. According to the Supreme Court, does money equal speech? Do corporations have the same First Amendment rights as individuals? Today we'll talk about the Constitution, corporations, and money in politics. This is President Obama giving his 2010 State of the Union address.
Last week, the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections. I don't think American elections should be bankrolled by America's most powerful interests, or worse, by foreign entities. They should be decided by the American people. And I'd urge Democrats and Republicans to pass a bill that helps correct some of these problems.
That was President Barack Obama delivering his 2010 State of the Union address. Today, as part of our continuing series on landmark legal decisions, we're going to talk about that case, Citizens United. Joining me in the WEM studio is Joe Schwartz. He's a medical doctor, a former member of the Michigan Senate, and the U.S. House of Representatives. Congressman Schwartz now lectures at the U of M Ford School of Public Policy, where he teaches courses on Congress and state legislatures. Joe, welcome.
Thanks very much, Lynn. Nice to be with you.
It's very nice to have you here. Joining us by phone is Elizabeth Wydra. Ms. Wydra is chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Elizabeth, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always nice to have you here. This is a case, unlike some of the other ones that we have done, which are more historical. This is one we all know about. We've all heard about, and it comes up again and again. So, Elizabeth, I'm going to turn to you. Lay the scenario out for us. What was the dispute here?
Well, you know, Citizens United actually didn't start out as Citizens United as we know it. It began as a fairly sleepy case during the 2008 presidential primary season. A corporation called Citizens United planned to release a film critical of Senator Hillary Clinton, who was then running for president, entitled Hillary the Movie, through video on demand, a pay-per-view service. In its Supreme Court appeal, Citizens United argued that it had a First Amendment right to an exemption from campaign finance regulations because a feature-length film, which would be seen only by the viewers willing to pay for it, was fundamentally different from the 30 or 60-second broadcast ads that Congress had targeted in preventing certain corporate campaign expenditures. Of course, this all changed when, on the very last day of the 2008 October term, the Supreme Court, sua sponte, on its own, ordered new briefing on whether two key precedents, including a part of McConnell versus the Federal Election Commission, which had just been decided in 2003, should be overruled. And so with that, the court held a special session, which is very, very rare, on September 9th, 2009, and the court reheard arguments. And after that, the Supreme Court issued its ruling in Citizens United that you heard President Obama speak of, and that's how we got to the case that we have now.
Well, there are a number of things that happen before we get to this. And the dispute, of course, is around money in politics, corporate money in politics. The Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act is sort of not necessarily at the heart. The heart is really about money, corporations, the Constitution. But let's talk a little bit about the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. Now, Joe, when you got to Congress, this was already being challenged. You know, what was the concern? What were people opposed to?
Well, everything, if you if you want to be out there just kind of freelancing in electoral financing becomes an emanation from a penumbra of the First Amendment. And that was always the case. McCain-Feingold really trampled on people's First Amendment rights. You could do anything you want. You could give any amount of money you wanted, and so on. And I think that led up to Citizens United, where now you can do precisely that. And not only can you give any amount you want, it's never going to be traced back to you if you give it to the right 501c4. So we've come a long way, and quite frankly, it's the wrong way.
Well, one of the things that I remember, I was in Congress and part of the group that worked on BCRA, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. One of the concerns was is that there was this big loophole in regulation of campaign spending, campaign donations, and that was the so-called issue ad. Elizabeth, why don't you explain that to us?
So the idea is that under this loophole for the issue ad, a corporation could spend money that's not technically donated directly to a candidate, which would be prohibited, but rather does everything but advocate for the election or defeat of a certain candidate. And so in a sense, it would be an extension of advocating for that particular candidate, even though it would claim to be just about, you know, labor issues or drilling or something like that.
Well, this wasn't just corporations. The parties were doing this. Various other groups were doing it.
Yes, right.
And so, I mean, is it fair to say that what the Reform Act was trying to do is it was trying to make sure that money spent in actual electioneering and campaigning was being spent in the way that was or was coming into the campaign in a way that was legal?
Correct.
Great. Okay, so we get the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, but there's more to the story before that. Let's talk. Well, first, let me remind listeners that this is the Lynn Rivers Show here on 89.1 WEMU, and my guests today are Congressman Joe Schwartz and Elizabeth Wydra, who is the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center. So, Elizabeth, we got a series of cases. I was going to say let's do Buckley v. Valeo, but let's go back to the early 1900s and explain to us the history of regulating campaign money.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the idea that through the law we could prevent improper corporate influence on the electoral process has been a pillar of our modern democracy. You know, concern that corporations were corrupting elections motivated passage of the Tillman Act of 1907, which is really the first piece of federal corporate campaign finance legislation. And it also was a motivating factor behind the ratification of the 17th Amendment, which gives individuals in each state the right to directly vote for their U.S. senator instead of having the state legislatures do it.
Mm-hmm. So Joe, let me turn to you, because we start with the limitations on corporate activity in 1907. Come the war years, Congress takes another look at it, and this time they focus on unions. What was the law around union participation?
I don't know precisely what the law around union participation is, but I can say that I can recall, because I am a gentleman of a certain age now, there was regulation, and unions were prevented from doing certain things, as were corporations. And the money, and the thing that I liked about it then that I don't particularly care for now, is that the money had to be accounted for. And I never cared one way or the other whether unions participated either for or against me, or individuals who obviously were representing the corporation who employed them but writing checks with their own signature on them were for or against me. The thing that bothers me more than anything else now is that there is no accountability. And money corrupts, and the way things are right now, money corrupts totally, completely.
I happen to agree with you, particularly when that money cannot be traced in any way, shape, or form. Huge numbers of dollars coming into the process. But I want to sort of look at the legal path this takes, because we find in the early 1900s, Congress is regulating contributions into federal campaigns. They add unions to corporations in terms of union dues money in the during the war years. And everybody seems to accept that. The court says that that's a reasonable thing to do. Why, Elizabeth?
Our first sort of modern campaign finance ruling came in 1971 when Justice Powell on the Supreme Court wrote a it's the early 70s, not exactly 1971, wrote in First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti that corporations had a right to spend money in proposition elections or referendum on a particular issue. So he held that corporations did have the right to spend even though they had previously been prohibited. Now, that was vigorously dissented from by Justice Rehnquist, who had become the chief and who is, you know, no liberal. And he said, you know, this is not right. Our Constitution and our legal history has always distinguished between an individual and a corporation. And this makes eminent sense because corporations are given special privileges like perpetual life and limited liability that are beneficial in the economic sphere, but as Rehnquist said, pose special dangers in the political sphere. So, you know, that was sort of really the first time that we had these two warring camps over the appropriateness of campaign corporate finance regulation.
Well, to go back to the issue, though, about the sort of the first two cuts at limiting contributions, there was a lot of controversy around this and whether or not Congress had the ability to regulate federal elections to the extent that people's First Amendment rights might have been abridged. Now, the court weighs in on that, don't they? Don't they say that this is a trade-off necessary to maintain a support for the system, trust in the system?
Yeah, I mean, certainly with respect to individuals. I mean, that's a very different issue because you're talking about an individual person with an individual right under the First Amendment guarantee of free speech to make his or her voice heard in the political system. And the court found that the idea that you need money to do that in many cases was a valid one.
Well, let's go to Buckley v. Valeo, because that's one of the predecessors to this issue. As you said, we get the issue of corporations having perhaps the same standing as individuals out of the Powell decision. But what does Buckley v. Valeo stand for?
So in Buckley, which is a 1976 case, the Supreme Court upheld a federal law which set limits on campaign contributions, but it nonetheless ruled that spending money to influence elections is a form of constitutionally protected free speech. And that's the first time that the court really, by doing so, struck down other portions of the law. And that's really the first time that we have the Supreme Court articulating this idea that money equals speech. The court also ruled in that case that candidates can give unlimited amounts of money to their own campaigns, which of course has, you know, given rise to this phenomenon of people spending large amounts of money to get themselves elected.
Now, when I was researching this, I sort of ranged far afield looking for information, looking for interesting points of view on this, and I came across this song, and we're going to play you a little bit of it.
To the corporation, big business CEO, oh, we're gonna run the nation in 2013 January, Ronald McDonald inauguration, Pepsi Cola, Exxon Mobil, they got to pen to write the legislation, they so hold my votes, I got no hope. This is no joke. Day is so hold my votes. Senator Lockheed Martin, all they want to know is who we're bombing. The fast food
Bobby Wright the chick. Put the calorie round our neck. In our race, say what we got to pay. Put the guns in the school today. The union doing what they can to keep up with the money man. Today, so put my vote.
And we're talking about Citizens United. This is a song, as I said, I found on the internet that a fellow sort of spontaneously sat down, put his video camera on, and recorded for YouTube. I think, though, that there's a sentiment here, Elizabeth, that is widespread, that somehow this decision hijacks sort of the vote of the individual or the influence of the individual in favor of large corporations.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not just amongst, you know, the left or the right. This is an issue that unites Americans across the political spectrum in being opposed to the Citizens United decision. And I think there are two reasons why people are so up in arms. One is that, obviously, the substantive issue that the court is going to essentially allow corporations to drown out the voice, as you heard in that song, of individual Americans by flooding races with money from their general treasury funds. But also the idea of this extremely activist court, and especially from these conservative justices who professed at their nomination hearings to be all about judicial restraint, et cetera, when they really reached out and reversed established precedent in order to give corporations this right to spend in our electoral process.
Well, I want to come back to that in a second, but I want to turn to Joe for a moment. And while we're discussing a legal case, I want to talk policy for a second, Joe. You have served at every level. You've been councilman, you have been a mayor, a state senator, and then a member of the United States House of Representatives. What does your experience tell you about money in politics?
Well, money, at first, it's pervasive in politics. Fewer dollars at lower levels, obviously, but pervasive. And the loosening of controls over the money that comes in is corrupting. And there's no question about that. One of the things that amazed me, and it's pretty difficult to amaze me, but one of the things that amazed me was when I was in Washington and in the House of Representatives, the amount of time that members of the U.S. House spent raising money as opposed to the amount of time they spent working on public policy issues. And I can tell you that in many cases the former was greater than the latter. Even for someone like myself, that was quite a surprise. And what's going to happen in this 2012 election cycle, I think, will knock people's socks off. We're going to be wallowing in money. And I expect after the 2012 election, and I hope after the 2012 election, that the issue will be revisited.
Well, this idea that speech is money, or I'm sorry, that money is speech, that if I've got money, whether I'm an individual, whether I'm a corporation, whether I'm an organization, I should be able to spend money on elections. Maybe I can't give it to the candidate directly, but I should be able to spend as much as I want in order to promote my point of view, my First Amendment rights to do that. What do you think about that interpretation?
Yeah, I don't care how much you spend. I want to know who you are. I want to know where the money comes from. I want to know where every cent comes from in support of one candidate or another. I don't necessarily want to put any limitations on it, but within 48 hours, after the money is presented to a candidate's campaign, I want it up on the net, who gave the money and how much, so people can see.
So your concern is not so much the amount. Your concern is transparency. Where does the money, and then we leave it to the voter. If you want to vote for a guy who got $1 million from one man, you can do that.
Or wrote a $1 million check themselves. Which is not the self-funders, as a counselor indicated, are rife out there. Now there are lots of self-funders. I just want to know where the money came from. That tells me a great deal.
Well, Elizabeth, there is an issue with this Citizens United decision about transparency. What sorts of requirements does this case put on corporate spending?
So right now, the way that the law stands is that the Supreme Court and Citizens United did not strike down disclosure requirements. Those were also at issue in the case. But as I think Joe is getting at, you know, those disclosure requirements can be easily circumvented by donating to the right group. You know, so you donate to a group, you know, Americans for America, you know, and yes. And you can then shield your identity by doing that. So, you know, I think Congress could pass stricter disclosure laws, but with the way things stand, the existing ones haven't been struck down, but I don't know if they're terribly effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to the genesis of this case. Now, the case that preceded this, or the case that should have provided precedent for this decision, was the Austin case, which came out of Michigan. Elizabeth, lay the groundwork for us here.
Yeah, absolutely. So in 1990, there was a case called Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce. And the law at issue was a Michigan law that barred corporations from using their general treasury funds, this is as opposed to sort of specific political action committee funds. So it barred corporations from using their general treasury funds, you know, their general profits, to advocate the election or defeat of statewide office candidates. And the court upheld that law, you know, by emphasizing that the Michigan state government had a compelling interest in regulating corporate spending on elections and to ensure that corporations did not use their special privileges that were given to them to operate efficiently in the marketplace to dominate the electoral process.
Well, didn't that state law mirror what Congress did in 1907?
Yes.
I mean, wasn't that essentially the limitation Congress had put in federal
yes.
elections?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the precedent. The court, in deciding Citizens United, expressly strikes it down, says it was wrongly decided.
Absolutely.
Tell me about this court today versus the court that addressed Austin.
Well, you know, it's a lot of people, again, think of this as sort of a left-right issue, but when you look at some of the cases in the earlier courts, you know, you had Chief Justice Rehnquist making a very strong argument in support of campaign finance limitations on corporations. And, you know, this goes back to the founding. Chief Justice Marshall, in the very beginning of our country's history, noted that corporations are artificial entities, not people, and therefore can be subject to greater regulation than an individual could be. And I think this gets to Joe's point that it's not necessarily how much money is spent, but, you know, transparency and also who's spending it. Is it a corporation using their general treasury funds that they amass profit for, you know, rightfully in order to promote our economic welfare and create jobs? But that's not money that is intended necessarily to be used for political participation. Corporations can't vote in elections. They can't participate in the way that individuals can. And members of the court in the past have recognized that, regardless of whether they're on sort of the right or left of the political spectrum.
Joe, how do you feel about that? You know, you said you're not as concerned about the amount, you're concerned about transparency. Does the source, in terms of, say Mobil, Exxon, they want to put gazillions of dollars in, does that bother you?
Let me bring it closer to home. In 2008, we had an initiatory proposal on the ballot here that allowed human embryonic stem cell research in this state. Some opposed, some in favor of. I chaired the group in favor.
And we're here to talk about it, yes.
Yeah. And we raised about $6 million, and every penny of it was accounted for. People knew where every bit of that money came from. We had one big supporter. We had others to a lesser degree, but every penny, you knew where it came from. Our opposition, and there were numbers of opposition groups, funneled all their money through the Michigan Catholic Conference. Let me hasten to add, I am a Catholic. We don't know where the money came from. And I know darn well that the Michigan Catholic Conference did not have $6 million, and it was about $6 million to spend to oppose stem cell research. And we still don't know where that money came from. And I would love to know who supported the opposition to stem cell research. But by golly, I don't think we will ever know, and I think it's important to know, but we won't.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU. We are talking about the Supreme Court case, Citizens United, and my guests today are Congressman Joe Schwartz and Elizabeth Wydra, who is the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center. There we go. Joe, I want to stay with you for a minute, though, in terms of the difference. Now, as a candidate for Congress, there are rules about campaigns that are different from what we're talking about here. Are there limits on how much a member, a congressional candidate, can take from a particular source?
Yes, there are limits on the amounts of money that you can take from a particular source, and the reporting requirements, I think, are fair. They're strict but fair. You can't coordinate with another organization that isn't a part of specifically a part of your campaign. There are lots of rules, and I think the Federal Elections Commission has done, by and large, a pretty good job of trying to enforce them, although it's the whole enterprise is so large, I don't think they can enforce it all. But there are rules. Most members abide by the rules. Others obviously don't. But I believe the big problem is and will continue to be the absolute tsunami of money that comes into congressional campaigns for the U.S. Senate, especially campaigns at that level. And there's no way whatsoever that we're really going to be able to trace it all. And now with Citizens United, it really is going to be untraceable.
Well, and then there's also the question, given that this was, I'm addressing this to you, Elizabeth, given that this was a constitutional matter, it wasn't the court's reading on a particular statute. I mean, they made a very clear point about First Amendment rights here. Is there any way to undo this legislatively, or is this going to take some sort of a change to the Constitution?
I think it has to be constitutional. I'm in danger here of probably irritating some people, but people need to remember that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights now are 225 or so years old, and interpretations then are different than interpretations would be now, and you have to look at them through glasses that are 2011 glasses, and that's not happening. And so to totally unequivocally equate money in politics with someone's First Amendment rights, I think really does go a bridge too far.
Okay. And Elizabeth, what are the options given that?
Well, first, I just want to disagree with Joe a little bit on that. You know, I don't think actually there's anything wrong with the Constitution. In fact, I think the founders would be horrified with Citizens United. They wrote into this text and structure of the Constitution many safeguards to prevent against corruption in the political system. And in fact, precedents from the very beginning of our nation all the way up until 2003 when the Supreme Court upheld the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act were appropriately applying the Constitution. As Justice Stevens wrote in his dissent in Citizens United, the only thing that has changed since then was the makeup of the Supreme Court. So I think that probably the best thing would be to change the makeup of the court and get a court who will apply the text and history of the Constitution appropriately.
Well, I mean, that's certainly an issue that, depending on whatever side of the aisle you are on, you may like the court, you may not. But in terms of legal options, this can't be undone legislatively, can it?
No, because as you said, it is a constitutional ruling, and Congress cannot go against that through legislation. You know, there can be attempts to work around it, again, perhaps by strengthening disclosure requirements, and I believe Congress is looking into that. There are other means of attempting to go through public financing, but as we saw last term in a case called Arizona Free Enterprise Club versus Bennett, the Supreme Court is going to be very strict about those efforts as well. So in that case, the court struck down Arizona's system of public financing for state races, which was actually very effective in curbing corruption and increasing the political participation of individual Americans, which is really what we should be focusing on.
Mm-hmm. Joe, I'm going to put you on the spot for a minute.
What a surprise.
Well, when we were working on BCRA, in my experience and in my opinion, the greatest opponents to campaign finance reform were the leaders in both parties. In other words, you had sort of a populist effort within Congress. You had people on both sides of the aisle that wanted to see things change. They wanted to see soft money go away. They wanted to see these issue ad loophole, wanted to see that closed. And the leadership in both parties, in both houses, actively worked against it. Did you find the same thing when you were there?
Yeah, sure. The leaders, at least one of their primary responsibilities is to win as many seats as they possibly can, and if possible, the majority. And that's right at the top of the list. So it should come as no surprise to anyone that the leaders want to have as much leeway as they possibly can to raise as much money as they can to elect as many members as they can.
Mm-hmm. Actually, when I was there, we brought the issue to the floor on a discharge petition. The speaker would not schedule it. It was Jenny Hastert at the time, would not schedule it. Because of the discharge petition, he was obligated under the rules of the House to schedule it. So he scheduled it. We started debate at, I think it was 11:30 at night, so that we debated in the middle of the night when no one would be watching us. But that raises a different issue, Joe. I want to turn back to you. Now that we have corporate funds, how do you think that's going to affect the role of the parties?
Well, if it's corporate funds, the corporate funds will probably flow a majority of them one way and not the other. But union funds are included here. The unions can do precisely
the same thing,
and it may be a wash. It may not be. I just think the sheer amount of money that we're going to see in the 2012 election and possibly beyond if nothing is done about it is going to be a turnoff to a lot of people. And more's the pity. Because voter turnout right now isn't what it ought to be. And if people think, well, what the difference is my vote going to make because somebody's going to go out and buy 50 of them to counteract my one vote, why vote at all?
Well, and that's an attitude, unfortunately, that is very prevalent with young people. They feel like it's become, it's irrelevant. Voting is irrelevant. But, Elizabeth, I want to go back to a different aspect of this. When I was reading the case, I mean, it's a very strange situation. These people made a movie about Hillary Clinton. Everyone agrees, very unflattering, very much sends a message that she was inadequate to the job, shouldn't be president of the United States. But they're essentially selling it. They want to broadcast it pay for view. So I'm only going to see it if I want to, if I pay for it. How does that fit into this idea that we're trying to ratchet back on electioneering? I mean, that was the loophole that was supposed to be being closed, which is you get these issue ads where it attacks on a particular issue, and then they say, call Representative so-and-so and tell him to stop doing this thing, and they say, well, that's an issue ad. It's not electioneering. But this seems to be of a different caliber. This movie doesn't seem to fit into that category.
Well, that was what the case was initially all about. It was really sort of the characterization of the movie, and if it were characterized to be electioneering, then it would be it wouldn't be, of course, you know, shut down, but it would be subject to certain restrictions about when you could broadcast it in terms of proximity to the actual election day and other disclosure requirements. So that was really the issue at the beginning of the case.
Well, let me keep going on that, because this raised some real issues for me. As one of the justices pointed out, or asked, I guess, in oral arguments, asked, what about if they published a book? Would they be allowed to put the book out within X number of days of an election? And the answer, of course, is yes. So why do we make a distinction between books and a television show, a movie?
Well, you know, that, I think, was that exchange at the initial, the first set of oral arguments, the suggestion by the representative from the United States Solicitor General's office that the government could ban books. You know, and you never want to be mailing books. You know, I think it might have been the spur to sort of this broader explosion of Citizens United, the case into what it is now and the need for rehearing, et cetera. And the government never really gave a great answer on that. You know, Elena Kagan, before she was a justice, when she was Solicitor General, you know, she argued the re-argument of Citizens United and said, you know, well, the government would never do that. But that's not really a great answer in terms of the Constitution and protection of free speech.
Joe, I want to turn to you. Both of us were longtime office holders. Both of us found out the reality of having to raise money. But I agree with you. It is the most onerous. It's the most awful thing. And so much time and energy goes into it. But we're left with, that's the devil we know. How do we change? What do we go to? Now, you say transparency is an issue that you would look at. What about things like state-funded elections? Are there other ways that you would feel comfortable to approach this?
Well, those are all questions that have come up and solutions as well. I believe at some point we're going to go to at least quasi-public funding as the dollars get out of hand. It may not be in the next 2 years or 4 years or 6 years or 8 years, but I believe we're going to do that. The second thing I believe ultimately we will do is limit, and this is going to be a First Amendment question, but there may be some way to do it. The good counselor can probably comment on that as well. Maybe limit the time an active campaign can go on, much like they do in the UK. I mean, it is presidential campaigns now last 4 years. Congressional campaigns last 2 years. It's the endless campaign. And if it's the endless campaign, it is the endless raising of funds, which I found as distasteful as you. In fact, refused to cold call people. I said, I'm not going to do it. People don't want to be cold called, and I am not going to do it. I'll hold fundraisers in my district, and I will hold fundraisers in Washington. Not that I particularly wanted to, but I understood it was part of what you had to do. But going over to the campaign office every night when you're in Washington and cold calling, not only into your own district, but darn near everywhere,
right,
was terribly distasteful.
Mm-hmm. Probably both ends of the telephone, the people you're calling as well as having to make the calls. But, you know, you mentioned public funding, that too much money is going to come in. It happened just the opposite with the presidency. In other words, people used to take the public funding. Now they can make so much money, they can raise so much money outside of that system that we've walked away. And each successive presidential election, the money has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, the prudent person would say limit the money, and the First Amendment devotees would say you can't limit the money. So that argument will be had, and I expect the First Amendment devotees will win, and we won't limit the money. But more's the pity. There will be a huge scandal sometime, or scandals, and those scandals will be based on the fact that there's no way that this huge amount of money can be traced, and it's gone the wrong place to the wrong person. Who knows what will happen, but that's where we're headed.
Elizabeth, give us, the court makes a distinction between limiting contributions to candidates and limiting expenditures by candidates. Can you sort of explain that?
The idea is that the expenditure is a more direct form of speech as opposed to a contribution to then allow someone else to finance his or her own speech, the candidate directly. But, you know, while technically Citizens United left in place the limitations on corporations in donating directly to candidates and the limitations, frankly, on individuals in donating directly to candidates, you know, you could take the logic of the opinion far enough to strike down even those limitations. If the idea is that, you know, money is speech and there's no government interest in preventing corruption, only in sort of preventing quid pro quo bribery, essentially.
Well, did the court, I mean, part of the constitutional decision-making around this was a recognition that Congress had a legitimate aim in dealing with corruption. Joe has mentioned a couple of times here that this money is corruptive. The court recognized that and said you can limit donations, contributions. But wasn't the argument what a campaign spends is not corruptive? It's not what the money goes to. It's where the money comes from. I mean, is that a fair rendering of how the court handled that?
I think that is a very generous rendering of how the court handled that. You know, I think that it's very problematic when you look at how the court is narrowly defining what corruption means. And there used to be, in these cases, you know, in the Austin case, the Michigan state case, those cases gave a somewhat broader view of corruption as something that is not just about, you know, quid pro quo bribery itself, but also the appearance of corruption.
Right.
You know, if there are these floods of money coming in, you know, is the American public going to have faith in their political system? And the Citizens United Court basically took that additional government interest in preventing the appearance of corruption out of the equation.
So what do we do? Okay, we understand what the decision says. We understand to a certain degree what it allows for. But how do folks who want to see some progress around this issue, what do we do? Congressman Swartz said, well, maybe we need to we need to look at public funding. Maybe we need to look at this or that. Almost every one of those ideas have been slapped back in one way or another. I mean, as a lawyer, do you see a way home with the First Amendment as the way we interpret it?
Well, I think, you know, the failure of those reforms have been a failure of political will and not a constitutional obstacle. You know, the Disclose Act, which would have required nonprofit groups to reveal the donors behind their vast election war chest, you know, was filibustered, was threatened to be filibustered by Senate Republicans. So, you know, that's certainly still a possibility. And I think if the American people, you know, share the sentiment that Congressman Schwartz has been expressing on this show, then perhaps they can come behind that. Additionally, in the public financing, it's proven rather successful in the states that have adopted good programs. But as we saw in the Supreme Court last term when it struck down Arizona's campaign financing system, it's very difficult under this court's current First Amendment campaign finance jurisprudence to craft an effective and constitutional public financing system, because the court in the Arizona case said, look, you can't limit the amount, you can't give more money to a person in the public financing system if their opponent is spending more money. But that's frankly the only way to make it work without giving gobs and gobs of money to every single candidate, regardless of whether the race is a high-dollar race or, you know, a much lower race. So, you know, we have to come up with some real creative solutions in the public campaign financing sphere.
Well, with the public campaign financing, I mean, not this most recent court, but courts in the past have ruled that in order for one of those kinds of programs to be constitutional, it has to be voluntary, that we can't make candidates fund through public financing, limit their fundraising. Now, how do we get around that? I mean, that's not the current court. That's a previous court.
Yes, well, they definitely have to be voluntary. The court has said that. But I think what some of the newer systems have reflected is a desire to make them attractive. So you will voluntarily opt in. And that's what Arizona did very effectively before the Supreme Court shut them down last term.
Now, Joe, we talked a little while ago about self-funded candidates. Now, have you ever had an opponent that did that?
I've never had an opponent that self-funded. I don't believe I have, but I certainly have been involved in races where there were self-funders. And the recent gubernatorial race in Michigan, at least in the primary, Governor Snyder would certainly could be described as a self-funder, whereas his main opponents, Mike Cox and Pete Hoekstra, were having a very difficult time to raise at adequate dollars. But First Amendment is First Amendment, and there's absolutely nothing that says a self-funder, whomever it might be, can't write themselves a check, write their campaign a check, and do it. So I don't think you're going to have any luck in saying people can't self-fund. They can self-fund, and there's a lot of wealth out there. And I can't criticize it and say it's wrong. All I can say is that I like it better when people basically can go into a campaign with equal sorts of financial backing. I think it makes a little bit better campaign.
Well, now the court said that in Arizona, we can't take into consideration that one candidate may be able to write big, big checks and the other one is out trying to raise money in $20 amounts.
The Arizona law said that we will give you more money.
Right.
If that's the case. And that's an issue, obviously, that hasn't been decided. The Arizona law has been decided. But the issue of self-funders, I think, will come up again. But again, self-funders are here to stay, and I don't know that we need to dwell on that because they are here to stay and they will spend their money. Mayor Bloomberg of New York, of course, is the preeminent self-funder, but there are others.
Mm-hmm. This is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU, and we are talking today about the Supreme Court case Citizens United, and my guests are former Congressman Joe Schwartz and Elizabeth Wydra, who's chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center. Elizabeth, I want to go back to you with these alternatives, what we can do. What kind of system do you see? Now, you're a constitutional scholar. You're also a student of politics. What kind of system do you see that would address this First Amendment issue in general and also create a level playing field?
Well, I think it's really difficult. We do have these First Amendment values of free speech and political expression, which I think are very valuable and fundamental to our democracy. But at the same time, particularly with the extreme economic inequality in the country and the presence of very powerful corporations, we have difficulties in making the equal playing field a reality. And, if you look at this has been a concern since the founding. In 1864, President Lincoln predicted that, because of the wealth amassed after the war in certain corporations, he said, an era of corruption in high places will follow. So this has been a problem for a long time. I'm not sure I can come up with anything better than President Lincoln would have. But I think that the public financing systems are certainly something hopeful. We have really creative, brilliant legal minds like Bruce Ackerman from Yale Law School, who has suggested a plan, I think it's called Freedom Dollars, where we have this vast public financing system where everyone gets a certain amount of money that they can then put behind the candidate that he or she thinks is best. So I think it is time to really get creative, and it's time for the American people to really think about this issue closely and ensure that there's the political will to do what it takes to reduce corruption because of big money and campaign financing.
Joe, are you hopeful, or do you think this is just something we're going to have to learn to live with?
Oh, I'm ever hopeful. The problem will be in 2012, but I think people will realize in 2012 that there's something wrong with the way we pay for elections, especially at the federal level and the statewide level, and perhaps there's a better way to do it. And in my mind, I don't care so much about the amount. I know the amount is coming in, but I think it's critical. It's essential that we know where the money comes from. And if you don't know where the money comes from, it's not a good situation, and that's what we have now.
And that is the last word. I want to thank my guests for being here today, Congressman Joe Schwartz, Elizabeth Wydra. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Listeners, please join me next week for another edition of the Lynn Rivers Show, when we'll talk about the news, politics, history, or maybe a mixture thereof. Radio that makes you think. The Lynn Rivers Show, right here on 89.1 WEMU.